Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 23rd of February. First hour of our program today, we'll be talking about the Middle East. It started in Tunisia with a revolt that ousted the country's autocratic ruler. Now, huge protests in Libya, where protesters evidently have taken over the eastern part of the country, Yemen, Bahrain, Iran, and of course, Egypt. Our guest the first hour is a professor at Tennessee State University. We'll meet him in just one moment. And an update on what we'll be doing later today. We have been so flooded with emails and Facebook messages and phone calls during the last week as we've talked about the crisis in Wisconsin that we haven't had a chance to hear from all of you. We thought we would just open phone lines so that you can talk about what's happening here, our number two of our show. Tomorrow, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will be with us, and former Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow will also join us to discuss what is going on in the state of Wisconsin. We do have an invitation to the governor of the state of Wisconsin. We hope that he will join us for a program in the very near future. All right, this hour in the Middle East, a huge, huge story. And our guest is Assistant Professor of Political Science at East Tennessee State University. Professor Dilshad Ashalov is with us. He has a specialty in the areas of Middle East politics, political methodology, comparative politics, democratization, and comparative political analysis. He presents his research findings at national and international conferences, and he is also fluent in four languages. I always think this is so remarkable: English, Turkish, Uzbek, and Russian. Well, welcome phone calls. I'm sure there will be many because there are so many countries now involved in rebellion in the Middle East. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Ashalov, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you. My pleasure to be here today.
It is absolutely astounding how these protests are going from one nation to another nation to another nation. Can you explain why?
Yeah, it's actually a very we're watching the historical critical juncture. We say it's a major change that's sweeping through the Middle East. That the people want change, and people are protesting across the Arab world, as we see today. And to understand why it's happening, we really have to understand what was happening in the region before. It's definitely the accumulation of pressure that has been building over years. If you look at the political profile of the Arab world, we see that 90% of the Arab countries and the members of the Arab League were ruled by the dictatorships. And most of the opposition groups have been brutally repressed over the years. And we see that the accumulation of pressure have been building for over the years. And we see that pressure is being released, that people really wanting going around and expressing their voice. And, you know, I usually give that example, like a teacup example. You just imagine, like, you have, a cup of tea is being poured. And as the cup gets full, sometimes you just get one last drop that comes to that teacup and spills the tea all over.
Right.
And that's the – when we saw the uprising in Tunisia, a lot of people posed the question, is it an accident that we are seeing? Tunisia is a comparatively smaller country, but when we saw it on the larger scale that's spilling over to Egypt, a lot of people realized that, no, this is not an accident, this is not a coincidence, but this is a major change, or the people have gone outside and the opposition movements have emboldened themselves with change and they're protesting. And why it's spreading across like a domino effect, if you will, because you see that when people realize that, look, it is possible to see the long-term dictatorship go, because the long-held assumption that the authoritarian leaders are invulnerable has been shaken. And we saw that in Tunisia, who those who thought that it was an accident realized that no, it was not an accident when we saw the Mubarak regime who ruled Egypt for 30 years fell.
Right.
And we see that reaction spilling over, and that's the kind of the idea of change is stimulating. But also we have to realize it's the combination of factors that helps explain why we see that spread, the unrest in the Middle East. And another reason is the economic well-being, the high unemployment and the new generation of the people of the Middle East. If you look at the percentage of people who are under 25 years or younger, it's across the board, it's almost 50%. If you look at Libya, it's close to 60% is less than 25 years old.
Really?
Or in Egypt, it's 50%. And you can see, I know, can very comfortably say that it's almost half of the population in the Middle East under 25 years or younger. So we have definitely a young generation who's rising up, and most of the people on the streets, you see that it's really driven.
They're
by
very
this.
Young. Yes. Let's go to Libya first, where it is, in a way, hard to comprehend how somebody so entirely wacky as Gaddafi has been able to hold power there for such a long period of time. A couple questions here. One is, how has somebody who's so obviously wacky been able to hold that kind of power? And two, do you have any news sources? Who's able to get into that country right now to tell us how violent the crackdown against protesters is?
Yeah, so far we've been getting very, information, which is really hard to confirm, but the country is still controlling most of the communication systems in the country, and the Gaddafi being such an unstable ruler, and it's really not surprising to see the level of reaction. But it's really hard to really get information because of that communication problems, but a friend of mine have managed to send some videos, and people are trying to get some of the videos recorded on their cell phones, on some text messages, and it's amazing. I think some could have find a way to communicate by email, but it's the developments are unraveling so fast that it's really hard up. It's kind of hard to keep up with all the developments, but. We know that a lot of foreign citizens are being evacuated. That yesterday and today, the Turkish government have sent three large ships to transform their citizens. Now, at this time, is most access is happening by land, and there's a lot of uncertainty in the streets of Libya.
How has he been able to hold sway over that country for so many years? What policies has he put in place to keep people in line?
Yeah, it's the and again, it's the combination of factors, but primarily it's the his regime that's fueled by the repressing the opposition and justifying its regimes. And it's not about Libya as well. It's also we can apply it to all the other leaders have been around for many years, though the president of Yemen or Mubarak or Gaddafi. But Gaddafi is a little different case. While the other Arab leaders in the region have managed to get a lot of also support from the abroad, but in Gaddafi's case, even though he was at odds and conflict with the Western world, that also helped him unite among its people that he's, hey, look, I'm really putting against the West and I'm the leader who's really not corrupt as other leaders in the neighborhood, who are the allies of the West, the allies of those who oppressed us. But look, I'm really standing up, and I will defend our country. And also by doing that, he cracked down on the main opposition movements, and with its strong security apparatus, managed to build institutions around his reign to. Also, to win the support of the population, and at the same time, to give the atmosphere that, look, I am the guy who's going to deliver stability, and I'm strong, and I will provide. Because Libya is not a poor country, comparatively, because it's oil-rich. The GDP of the country is over $5,000. It's comparatively well-off to majority of the African countries, and that's why he was able to unite people behind his, you know, his ideology and his firm stance against the West. But that has been changing for the last 10 years. His institutional stronghold has been weakening mm-hmm. by the development of technologies, you know, open source, and a lot of factors like the rise of globalization and international communications, international education, the rising of the youth of population who really think differently now. All the older generation is really think differently compared to the young, new Arab generation that's rising up, who have Facebook accounts and Twitters, who read online, who travel abroad, who have totally different views of how the world is all about.
Right.
And that's kind of another engine that's driving this uprising.
When you look at Tunisia, when you look at Egypt and Libya and Yemen and Bahrain and even Iran now, and you look at the opposition movements, do you see a plan in place for when autocratic rulers are overthrown? Is there a plan in place in all of these nations? And is it a common kind of plan, or are things rather chaotic in terms of what will come next?
And that's a very important question to ask, because that's what we call them, what's next.
Yes.
So what's next is the most important question. And I'll answer that question shortly, not clearly, because it's really not clear if there is a plan, if any, because in some countries, for example, in the Libyan cases, there is not only one opposition. There are like 7 different factions of oppositions who are now united
against
Libya. So it's a question mark how the transition will work when the Gaddafi is gone, how they will reconcile their differences and then establish the government. So in some countries, it's more of a unified, but it's really we cannot really say that they have a clear plan of what's going to happen next or how the next government will function. But what we can say is they are united in one thing. And I think what's the immediate thing that has to come in the middle is to providing those 3 F's, we'll call them the 3 F's, the 3 fair and frequent elections from now on. And even though some countries have been frequent elections or a fair, I mean, they have to really get those 3 fair, frequent, and fair elections, that everyone is included in the political processes. Now, I think it's going to be premature to jump into conclusion that there's going to be a strong democracy arising in the Middle East. No, democracies don't arise overnight. It will take time. We all know that no democracy in the world have established their institutions so fast in a functional manner. So that's why institution building, we call in democracies, has like a 3 stages. It's seeding, nourishing, and sustaining stages. So let's say if the notion of freedom or the free country, which will be based on civil liberties and the political rights, is being seeded, and now the institutions being established, those institutions now that have to be nourished within the nutrients like freedom and transparency and support, and it will take time. And of course, the institutions to be sustain itself is another question. So therefore, what we see in the larger scheme is the opposition is gaining momentum. In some of the countries, the opposition is really not well organized. We saw that in the Egyptian case.
Yes.
Egypt fell relatively quickly, and the opposition is a lot more organized compared to Yemen and compared to other neighboring countries. But you can see like Muslim Brotherhood has been there around for like 90 years, was established in 1920. They've been very organized and have been major opposition movement for like 70-80 years. And they have more or less a plan, they have a more or less clear agenda of how they see, envision a new government. But in countries like Libya or Yemen, because of the oppositions are relatively young and need time to really think through about the institutional arrangements and resolve the differences among the other views in the opposition, it will take time. So it's we're just watching the process that's unfolding, and we kind of also have to overcome the time concept issue, we call them, because it will take time. That building a new, arranging a new system of government, and resolving their differences. And most importantly, keeping the lines of communication open, I think that's going to be the major victory.
Yeah.
But expecting a full democracy within a year or two, it would be too optimistic.
Well, the United States has formed some strange alliances in that part of the world, first because of the threat of communism, secondly because of the threat of radical Islam. And Gaddafi, in his bizarre speech yesterday, made reference to these bearded guys, and evidently that meant radical Islamists. Did he have a point, and do those people who worry about rise in radical Islam in these countries have a legitimate concern or not?
You know, I would say that there are two points to this question. The first one is, most of the authoritarian regimes have used the radicals, the extremists, as an excuse to legitimize their own governments. And from that perspective, the threat of the radicalism that's rising has been very overrated or overblown out of proportions. And that's kind of a pattern of the authoritarian countries to use that like a pretext. Look, if I go down, are you sure they're going to have stability? The radicals will come and take over the government. And that's why I'm fighting those governments for the state of security. It's kind of a very generic way of legitimizing their government. Just like you just said, the Libyan officials are arguing that, look, we're fighting the radicals in the streets. And they can probably show you some example. And it's really not the bigger threat in the larger Middle East. However, we also know that the rise of the radical Islam in the region is also partly linked to the repressive policies of those dictators.
Mm-hmm.
And those who really pushed the oppositions, who were fairly moderate, but because of the repressive tortures and humiliations that they endured in the prisons, for example, in certain cases, they went very extremely radical. And those who lost hope that the change is impossible through moderate or through peaceful ways went more radical. So we can also say that radicalism is partly responsible or partly linked, if not largely linked, to the repressive policies in that region. So I would say that actually reverse, if we have more open, transparent, democratic governments in the Middle East, that will deter the radicalism. So the answer to the radical Islam is opening up and freeing up the system.
Rebellion in the Arab world is our topic this hour of the program, and our guest is Professor Dilshad Ashalov. He is at East Tennessee State University, where his teaching and research interests are in the areas of Middle East politics, political methodology, comparative politics, democratization, and comparative political analysis. We welcome your phone calls. Lines are open right now, and we'll go to you momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, we, of course, are completely absorbed in the continuing story of collective bargaining, protests in Madison, filibusters in the assembly. We've had many guests over the course of the past week, and just not enough time. We've been overloaded with phone calls and emails and Facebook messages, so we thought we would open the phone lines for those of you who have not had a chance to speak. Not that we'll reach all of you, but some of you. Tomorrow, during our 9 o'clock hour, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will join us, along with former Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow. So that's coming up. And this conversation, of course, is continuing on the Ideas Network all day, and will continue for some days, I'm sure. Let's go to phone calls. Is it Mussie from Milwaukee?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm originally from East Africa, Eritrea, and we have the same dictator about almost 20 years, and the bad thing of them is, first of all, they are merciless and ignorant people, and they put around them for their security the people who are that I call one way thinking people. And the thing that they do is they try to eliminate the emerging leaders, intellectuals, and that's why it's their best way to control or to grab the power. But the thing is, most of the time, people, they are looking help from abroad, from outside of their country, because those dictators, they weaken them, and they become forceless or voiceless. So most of the time, the country like United States or Europe, somehow for their interest circle, they watch, but they don't intervene. Actually, it's right, because they cannot intervene for the sovereign country. But somehow, there is a way in circle to do or freeze or to ban their world around the world. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And where did you say you were from?
I'm from Eritrea.
Okay, Eritrea. Okay, thank you so much for the call. Professor Ashilov.
Yes, yes, I'm here.
Would you like to respond to him?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of a little hard to hear him, his questions.
Well, let's talk about what he said about intellectuals. He appears to be one of them, that people who are very, these dictators tend to be not very sophisticated, not very smart, and that the voices of intellectuals are silenced.
Yeah, you know, and that was the it's one of the another patterns we see where in the authoritarian countries. I would not generalize as the all the dictators in the country as not educated, or and most of them are actually, well, some of them, like the president of Syria, well, he's an educated, he's a doctor, is a medic by profession, and well, at least at an educational level, and most can speak English. So, rather than putting them as intellectuality levels, we can say that the power that they have, well, and the support, I think he pointed out very clearly that most of the leaders in the region did enjoy a lot of support from abroad, being an ally to the major Western powers. But yes, there is an rising intellectuals, or the those who teach at the universities, who have a more sophisticated education, who have seen the world outside, and who have done some work or have some passion to do some change in the government or for the sake of government. But the calculation or the cost of really seeing the change when you do take an action was so low that we haven't really seen a lot of actions until today. But the leaders that take in Libyan case, or like in, if you go back to Libya, I do agree that the leader of Libya, he's not only unstable, but his comments, when we just analyze the way he talks, the way he expresses his views, his intellectual level out is very, very, very questionable, very low. And I can give you one specific example where he proposed to vote to take the Switzerland out from the United Nations. Why? Because one of his sons had issues in Switzerland. Or another case when the Canadian government criticized Gaddafi, and Gaddafi just went that far to deny all the visas to all Canadians, which is not of an intellectual way of doing this. Or it shows the immaturity levels of some leaders who could, by doing this kind of actions, really decrease their reputation in the world.
Yeah, it's actually dumbfounding, isn't it, too? Although we've had our share of leaders who probably aren't very bright. But this guy, you keep thinking, what in the world? How in the world can you have power? You need to go back to school, honey. Goodbye. Get out of here. And it just doesn't happen. He's there for years and years and years. Thanks, Masi, for your call. Mike is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, and thanks for the program. One of the things that I've noticed, in the media and through some of the politicians over the years now, the last few years, is that these organizations or these political groups that are now the opposition groups that are Islamic in nature or Muslim in nature, have been brushed with a broad stroke as being radicals. I know you discussed this just a little bit earlier, but I guess more specifically, the question I have is about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Much has been made about the Muslim Brotherhood, whether it's from, you know, our government or other governments saying that, you know, we don't want them to take over because they're a radical organization. However, what I've come to find out in some of the research that I've done is that they're actually very moderate in terms of their leanings and their thoughts. And so I guess my question is about the Muslim Brotherhood. Am I correct in thinking that they're moderate rather than radical? And second is maybe you can just address this broad brush that these Islamic organizations or these Islamic opposition groups are being given. It just seems like if they have an Islamic principle or mission or vision, that all of a sudden they become radical despite there being no real violent history. If you can just discuss those two issues.
Thank you, Mike, for the call.
Sure. Absolutely. Very good question. And that's the question that's it's sweeping. I mean, this is the question that's grabbing the attention. If you look at the Middle East and the situation and unrest in the whole region, the default opposition has been the Islamist groups, and it's going to be very accurate to say that, you know, the default opposition to all that against the authoritarian countries have been the Islamist groups. And in the case of Muslim Brotherhood, yes. In your account of Muslim Brotherhood has very high moderate views. It is more of a moderate movement who is envisioning the role of Islam to play in the government, but with the guarantees of civil liberties and political rights. But we also have to note a little caution there. Muslim Brotherhood was established in 1920. It has a long history. It's the oldest Islamist organization in the world, and there's a lot of chapters in different parts of the Middle East. It's not only in Egypt, although some of its members have went radical. Some of its adherents, who are quite moderate, have gone pursued more radical venues. But if you look at the core of the Muslim Brotherhood's intention, so far they've been promising very moderate views, and they've been promising to deliver that if they would come to power, that they will deliver civil liberties, political rights, and economic prosperity. And they will do so by integrating Islam into government. And they've been arguing that the Islam and democracy can coexist. And they cite a lot of examples where, and if you look at history, we know that after Muhammad, the four caliphs were elected, and there were some concepts and values that can support democratization with a concept of shura, that elect the leader, so forth and so on. Anyway, that's what they've been promising. And one of the senior officials of Muslim Brotherhood have also referenced that as a Turkish model, where the leaders of the AKP party in Turkey, who has history or is coming from the Islamist roots, have done a terrific job in sponsoring the more democratic bills compared to all the previous secular regimes that came before them. It's a separate question, case of Turkey. However, Muslim Brotherhood is promising that if they would come to power, that they will deliver those democratic governance. Now, since we haven't seen them in action yet, since we haven't seen them in reality, it's going to be really hard to judge or jump into conclusion that they are just lying about their intention, or they're just radicals that they're not capable of. You know, just imagine you are in the lab. You are about to test some products. You know, without actual testing or running some tests, you cannot really draw some conclusions. In a similar pattern, if we don't allow the voice, if you don't see them in action in the government, whether they can or cannot deliver what they're promising, it's hard to make conclusions. Now, if Muslim Brotherhood will deliver what they're promising today, and they vision Islam and democracy will coexist, and they will deliver all those justices, then we will realize that, you know, yes, and the political Islam will gain momentum, and the coexistence between Islam and democracy will be substantiated. And if Muslim Brotherhood comes to power and enjoys the power in the parliament but fails to deliver what they're promising today, then the fears that some may have today will argue that, look, we were right. Look,
right.
We were right that they were not capable and they had more radical extreme views. So that's why that's the problem we have. For the long time in the Middle East, the Islamist movements were denied political voice, and that's what they want. That's why we have the default opposition is Islamist groups. Now, that's why they'll be under pressure to deliver if they come to power.
Let's go to Connie next in Madison. Hi, Connie.
Hi. It's a very good point to make a segue to the thought that I've been having. I've been spending a lot of time studying our own 18th century origins in the United States, and I think about how far back, all the way to Magna Carta in 1215, the beginnings of our institutions go. As I read about the very vitriolic clashes that occurred in the 18th century as at our founding, and some scholars would argue that not until the conclusion of our Civil War was our democracy fully secured. I think to myself, we stand on such a long story, and we are fortunate, I suppose, in the sense that we came about in that particular moment of the Enlightenment. But there is similar intellectual riches in the Islamic tradition. There are moments of such intellectual and philosophical brilliance that lies within the history of Islam that I think as people reach back into their own very rich and remarkable history and look for that which is the finest and the best in the midst of the internet age, looking at each other, knowing each other in a way that we could never have imagined before, I think I'm deciding to be optimistic, but not hasty in that it will take time. So thank you so much for this program this morning.
Thank you, Connie, for your call. Professor Ashalov?
Yeah, actually, I totally agree with you in your account. And we all know that at the birth of the U.S. Constitution, the Ten Commandments, or the religious vows, did play a role when we were crafting the structure of the government. And we all know that it did take time. For example, women's rights to vote in the United States, in American experience, were first introduced in 1848. It took 72 years before it became a law. Would be acceptable for women to vote in 1920s. So yeah, it does take time for institutions to develop and take roots. And if you look at in the Islamic world, yeah, just like that, the Islamic world has experienced very specific times where the science and technology thrived, and there were some checks and balances in place in some of the medieval countries where the king and sultan would pass its decree, its order, but it would be vetoed by one of the councils, a religious council. So there are some venues that further needs to be developed, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood or some of the moderate Islamist movements who are arguing that, look, we have to go back and study our heritage. Islam has a lot to offer to build a democratic state, because if you look at the Quranic teachings, the Islamic teachings, what does it say about to have what kind of political system to build? Well, there are not much details about what kind of government to build, what kind of political system to have. All Islam has is more general venue, like you have to have a government that's built on justice. So it doesn't say you have to have a parliamentary democracy or a presidential system. It's up to the people to figure that out, as long as it's based on general justice and things like that.
So are they indeed reading Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and about the life of George Washington? Are they looking at 18th century origins of the United States?
Do you mean that they would use that as a point of reference?
Yes.
Yeah, I think most of the movements, or moderate movements, if you say, show that as a reference, particularly when they make a case for the coexistence in Islam and democracy. They make a case that, look, yes, there is a separation of church, but it does not mean that total separation of church. They argue that going back to the twin toleration, that's the Alfred Stepan, is this political sciences in Columbia University, makes it their elaborate explanation of we never had the true separation of church from religion, because religion did play a role at the beginning of the American Foundation, how we defined the state, how we defined the marriage between the man and the woman, so forth and so on. The religion did play some role at the birth of the country. And the Islamist parties also make that reference that, look, Islam can be integrated within political system, and that can have a role. What doesn't mean that we have to have a total separation of Islam from politics, but rather we can have a coexistence that we call the twin toleration, when the politics can tolerate the religious values and religious values will tolerate them. Instead of separating concept, we can do coexistence or kind of a twin toleration system in place. And that's why we do some references, especially in American experience.
This hour of the program, we're talking about rebellion in Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, even Iran, Tunisia, Egypt. Who knows what country or countries will be added even by the end of the day. And our guest is a professor of political science at East Tennessee University. Professor Dilshad Ashalov is with us, and we're welcoming your phone calls. Thanks, Connie, for yours. One line is open. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email address, we'll get to some of your emails as well. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Over the course of the past week, we have spoken with so many people from the AFL-CIO, from the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, the former press secretary for Governor Lee Dreyfus, a professor of business administration at Marquette University, a guest from AFSCME, state senators Taylor and Hopper, who were with us yesterday. Tomorrow, Mayor Tom Barrett from Milwaukee and Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow will be with us. And we've been everybody has, as we've discussed this all over the network, flooded with phone calls and concern. And, well, just look at the number of people in Madison. We've only heard from a fraction of those of you who would like to be on the air and express your thoughts. So we're going to open phone lines for just that, our number two of our program this Wednesday. Habu from Madison is our next caller. Hi, Habu.
Well, hello, Kathleen, and to your guest, and thank you for this opportunity. You know, I missed the early part of your conversation here, so if I go in the wrong direction, please stop me.
All right.
But I limit my comments to Libya, the little I know about it. But I think it would be an analog for what applies to the rest of the region. You know, it is very unfortunate to see this thug, Gaddafi, use some of the worst weapons of killing people on his own people, and it's good to see that his pilots have landed in Benghazi in the enemy territory, as it were, or defected. I have a couple of questions and comments about Libya. One is that it seems like Libya, which is a small country, is really made up of tribes and clans. And if this changes to succeed, it would depend on the tribes giving the blessing to get him out. And some have already done so, saying if he kills their own people, that they will stop the oil flowing, which is a very big point of leverage. The other part is the military, and that apparently is divided. I'm wondering how that will happen. But just one comment. I've heard European states, you know, we usually think of the ugly American, you know, America kind of barking, but it's the European states that are becoming worse, looking even more ugly than the ugly American. They're saying something like, we can't stand to have an Islamic, Libya come out. And so much for democracy. It's almost like Henry Ford saying you can have any color car you want except a black one. But, and you know, the notion of the no-fly zone, which was brought up by the Libyan ambassador in the UN, but has kind of found some resonance in Europe, is a troubling one, because we remember the last time that happened, which was Iraq, at the end of the first Gulf War, that was continued until 2003, and, you know, attacking and killing innocent people in Iraq by U.S. And NATO fighters. So this kind of talk has to cease, and I hope there is more of an organic change in Libya, whatever it may be. And thank you.
Thank you, Habu. Professor Ashlov.
Yeah. You touched on a very important subject of the question. The question was about the structure of the Libyan society in terms of being it's more tribal. We've seen that the Gaddafi, who has used extensive force to secure his position, and the soldiers defecting, the military is divided, and it's the situation where his loyal security apparatus has been divided in its stance, and the whole country, yes, the tribalism is the part of the social fabric of the Libyans. And when the Gaddafi is gone, we see that there are seven major opposition groups, call them the in 2005, all those seven oppositions came together in London to establish the conference. They called them NCLO, the National Conference of Libyan Opposition. Well, they had some minor, disputes. They could not agree on certain things, and the conference was kind of got limited in 2008. But we know that's going to tell us that there will be some major players after Gaddafi is gone, and the tribal factor will be in a role to resolving those differences. And that's why I mentioned earlier the to see a democracy rising in Libya will be dependent on what kind of institutions they'll come to bring, and that's from that point on how they can sustain those institutions together. And that's why. Since Libya will be engaging in this process for the first time, and it's true to have a democratic state, there will be some hurdles to overcome, and there will be some disagreements among different opposition groups. But again, I said earlier, we do have to overcome the time concept problem, that we see that certain things just work fine or quickly in some countries. We cannot just apply that the same notion that it would just go and work there in Libya, and the institutions that's going to arise in Libya will have to be based on indigenous setting.
Mm. Could you? Here's an email that came in from Michelle while we're on this subject, who wants to know if the protesters in Libya succeed. Can you give us an idea, Professor, what the interim government might look like, because they don't seem to have the military option like Egypt?
Yeah, most probably it's going to be a mixed government. With I don't anticipate to see any clear-cut majority of political party emerging of those opposition movements. It seems that after the Gaddafi is gone, we tend to have more or less the coalition government or some of the opposition movements within Libya establishing the government where they can come together and establish a government. Again, that's the kind of a prediction. It's something that's kind of hard to do because this is the country that we're seeing that process for the first time, and it's really hard to predict and how those opposition movements will emerge and resolve their differences. And again, what's the immediate thing that has to come there is to ensuring the free and fair elections after Gaddafi is gone.
James in Janesville, hi.
Good morning, and thank you for the program. Now, I've had to take the interpreter's word for it, but on more than one occasion, I've listened to Ahmadinejad at the UN ranting about a 12th Imam and bringing about that leader with a mass bloodshed and a mass revolution and chaos. And I was just wondering what facet of Islam may be, you know, trying to bring that to the table and throw that into the mix as a, you know, ingredient of what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Yeah, I think it's a good question because we have to delineate Iran's role. First of all, Iran is a Shiite, they practice the Shiite Islam. There are two major denominations in Islam, the Shiites and Sunnis. Approximately 10 to 15% of the whole Islamic world practice Shiite Islam, and that's primarily Iran, Iraq, and Bahrain, and some of the other smaller countries. So we have basically three countries where there's a majority of Shiite population. And in terms of thinking at what Islam and democracy can come for, looking ahead, given that the strong rhetoric of Iranian president and the very theocratic state of Iran, will we see Iranian type of countries spreading through the Middle East? Questions are very well justified, but I do not anticipate, nor it will be accurate to anticipate Iranian type of regimes across the Middle East. Why? Because the Shiite Islam that's practiced in Iran has an aspect of it which is kind of contradicts the core of democracy. For example, the imams that was mentioned, or the supreme leaders, cannot be elected, but they have to have a link to the noble family, the prophet's family. The supreme leaders have to kind of be descendants of the family. And that's kind of split Shiite and Sunnis in 7th century. But in Sunni Islam, which is 90% of the Islamic world, who argue that anyone can be the leader of the country, anyone can be a president or prime minister, as long as that person is elected, as long as that person is supported by the society. So there is no necessary condition in Sunni Islam that a leader has to come from the prophet's family or just be a descendant of the noble family. So that kind of sets a notion that actually the Sunni world, the Arab world, we see that they're more likely to have more dynamic democracy as compared to a theocratic state in Iran if they would practice the Shiite and Sunni versions. And of course, we know that in Iran already people are rising up and questioning the theocratic regime, that a lot of people in Iran who do not agree with the political system, that the change is necessary there as well.
We haven't had much chance to talk about Bahrain, but I was watching the news on this last night, and they were saying, which I think is amazing, one-fifth of the country has been demonstrating. One-fifth.
Wow, that's a big number. Well, Bahrain is a small country.
Yes. Yeah. Let's go to Saeed in Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. Though I agree with your guess that the best antidote to radicalization is democratization, I totally disagree with his analysis of Islamic government. I think one has to look to the Maududi or Sayyid Qutb, the Sunni describers of Islamic government on the one hand, and Khomeini, the Shia describer of Islamic government on the other, and find a very common threat. In their analysis of Islamic government, they claim democracy to be a glorification of man, whereas Islamic government is a glorification of God. In democracy, the source of legitimacy is the assent of the governed. In Islamic government, the source of legitimacy is God. And while moderate statements made by the Muslim Brotherhood currently are definitely the fact, one has to put these against the background of over 100 years of history. And the statements of the Muslim Brotherhood are not dissimilar to what Khomeini was saying before he took power in Iran. I have my doubts as to whether Islamic government can ever be compatible with democracy.
Professor Ashilov.
Yeah. You know, I partly definitely agree with you, and that's one aspect that I said that, you know, I gave that live example. That's what the Islamist movements were claiming to deliver, the democratization, or to build a state where the Islam and democracy will coexist. And that's the claim that should be tested. And that's why I said they'll be under pressure to deliver. Now, what kind of evidence that they can show there? Well, they're making references to the states like in the Turkey is a secular government, or the Islamist or roots of the Islamist leaders are doing a terrific job in demonstrating where the Islam and the secular government can go hand in hand, or some sites of the Indonesian model where the Islam and the democratic state is substantiated. So there's some examples that those Muslim Brotherhood and some other Islamist groups show as a reference. Now, looking ahead, I do agree with you that, of course, in Islam, the legitimacy of the God's will, God's role will be the source, will definitely will be the point of discussion. But we have to also have to understand that there's a lot of movements, or the modern movements that have surfaced, who have really showed us what they can capable of, what kind of innovative institutions that they can provide us. We know that instead of Israel, Israel is a democracy, it is a vibrant democracy, and we see that the religious aspects where the Jewish state based on the a Judaized faith is integrated within the political and societal and economic aspects of life.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Professor Ashalov, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure to be here today.
Our guest this hour, Professor Dilshad Ashalov. He's a professor of political science at East Tennessee University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We will be doing, we'll open the phone lines to you with your comments. This is not an open line. It's just all the comments about what's going on in Wisconsin and now Ohio and Indiana and New Jersey that you didn't have a chance to express because we've been so darn busy. So the lines will be open after the news.